Welcome back to the second portion of today's 6 CEU seminar regarding professionally and ethically doing sound Christian psychotherapy. In this next section, we're going to begin by talking about the idea of what the literature calls God images and how to process counseling concerns in light of what a client might consider a definition of God in terms of how they see God operationally. So we're talking about the culture of a client's spiritual, religious, or God experience. Again, we want to meet the client where he or she is at. And this might involve understanding their language, how they operationally define things, any images they have associated with God, things like heaven, hope, light, healing, deliverance, salvation, and if there's any rituals by which the client would say he or she experiences God. So the literature would suggest that there's actually a process through which clients incorporate God image. First of all, they might have a conscious conflict in the sense of they might have been raised up with certain ideas about spirituality, religion, and God. So initially, they may notice that there's a difference between what they were taught or expected to believe. Maybe it's in their family of origin. Maybe it's what they think society or a church group believes. And then they come to this point of, I don't know if this is what I personally believe. Then that brings them to the second step of the process, which is called the time of pause, where they evaluate that contradiction. Then upon evaluating, they come up with an explanation or an insight to explain how they want to proceed from here. Then essentially what they're doing over time, and where we might come in terms of the counseling and psychotherapy process, is the fourth step of repatterning or reframing, which is helping the client to recompose his or her meaning surrounding what God is, what that spiritual experience is, what they thought it would be versus what it's ended up being. And then we help them interpret and provide new insight about their spiritual images. They've actually done some testing of people in terms of their self-statements regarding what they think of when they think of God. And when they did this assessment, for most people, the top ones that came to mind were love, a creator, someone who's always present, a friend. Now, if it was someone who is Christian-based, they might mention Jesus Christ. And then attributes of what they thought God entailed, like he is strength or he's peace. Other things that were included in the responses were things like comfort, support, forgiveness, a guide, compassion, patient, a mystery, a spirit, or powerful. So operational definitions of clients are important. Keep in mind that God image is related to many facets of well-being. When we're talking about development of God image over time, and the concept we mentioned in the first session of today's seminar of spiritual differentiation, we're talking about who we're becoming spiritually. Part of this for many people includes the concept of prayer. Prayer in the literature has been documented as something that is linked to a subjective sense of having an increase of faith, having greater activities associated with one's religious tradition, and more sense of meaning. Also, prayer has been linked with an overall concept of wellness. Now, if you've heard of genograms, you know they're basically a pictorial way of conceptualizing one's family of origin, one's history, and the nature of relationships that client has, kind of like a family tree. But the literature would also suggest that there's a way of adapting genograms to do one that's a little bit more of a spiritual genogram, so kind of a spiritual family tree. that might elicit some discussion about who are the people that are the so-called black sheep of the family, who have challenged certain spiritual principles or not had certain spirituality, or certain people who've had very hardcore beliefs one way or another about spirituality. And then we can look at how the client has responded to that. I also alluded to adapting some of the already efficacious approaches that the literature would suggest for many of our clients. I talked about how one of the most commonly used and efficacious types of treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy, which would suggest that it's not necessarily just what happens to us, but it's more about our perception of events, the antecedents, what's happened before, how we process it, our beliefs and thought patterns, our way of thinking about things, and then the choices we make and behaviors in response to it. A variation of this is called rational Christian therapy. And remember, as I stated in the first section, that we want to make sure that we're always using techniques that are ethically and professionally sound, that are demonstrated as being effective in the literature. We can incorporate someone's worldview, such as their spirituality, but we want to make sure that we're doing things that have been documented to have proven results. So with rational Christian therapy, we're using proven REBT, or rational emotive behavior therapy, but we're incorporating client belief systems and their spiritual worldview. So, for example, some of the things that commonly might come up with a Christian client are things like awfulizing. Oh, I expected if I was being, quote, spiritual or walking right with God or doing the moral ethical thing, then things wouldn't be so awful, terrible, or catastrophic. Sometimes they might have this belief of this low frustration tolerance. This such and such that I'm facing is just unbearable. There might be belief systems like self-downing or other downing, making decisions about guilt, shame, blame, how good, worthless, or useless they are or someone else's. Some of the things we're trying to highlight is, in spite of the automatic habitual nature of many of these automatic thoughts, we can incorporate some of their Christian worldview in terms of things about that even though I feel that things are awful and catastrophic, even though it's difficult making sense of why this seems so unjust, that I know based on my faith that God cannot separate us from His love, that it's all encompassing. I know that those who persevere are called blessed. I know that what other people say or do, or what appears to be happening, isn't necessarily the spiritual reality. So let's talk about some examples of specific misbeliefs that we see among Christian or spirituality-based clients. One is that God must answer my prayers the way I'd like Him to. So almost like, even though I'm going to say there's a supernatural God, that I have my way, that I think it should happen. Another type of misbelief is I absolutely should always be loved unconditionally by people no matter what. I ought to undeniably be obeyed or listened to when I'm speaking truth in terms of what someone believes is truth with scriptures, with their denominational background, their beliefs, or what they've been taught. Another belief we might hear from a client that we might need to work on is the idea of, I must never be judged. I must be totally accepted the way I am. Or the other end of the continuum, I must always be judged. I can't believe that God would ever love me or accept me as I am. We also might have some types of clients that are very performance-oriented. Maybe they have that assumption. If I do A, B, and C enough, then God will know that I deserve such and such outcome. I think the core one that I tend to deal the most with my clients is the idea that good people should always have good things happen to them and bad people should have bad things happen to them. We also see the idea of people should have mercy on me, but I want others to have justice or judgment. Then one of the other beliefs we see with some of our spirituality-based clients is this sense of paying back for what I did. I must atone for what I did. If I did something wrong, I've got to pay back. So one of the things that we'll notice a lot of times is that wrestling with the definition of what is sin and what is God's response to sin. Also, we might find that people approaching spirituality through a Christian worldview may believe that truth is that Christianity is the only true way to God. And that may be inherent in their belief system. They may believe that the answers to their problems are found in the Bible, and that the Bible essentially is an answer book that gives you keys to various issues in life. One of the things I find as a common theme with many of my Christian clients is the idea that they believe that only quote-unquote positive feelings are acceptable. So only joy, peace, happiness are acceptable. So a lot of times I find that clients struggle if they've gone through something very real and painful, like abuse or neglect, like some kind of devastation or trauma that just doesn't make any sense, some grief, some offense, some issues with unforgiveness. So a lot of times there's that wrestling about what feelings are okay and allowable. And so many times clients almost come in with this idea that it's not just the choices and the way I react, but how I feel that's wrong. So sometimes we have to do some education and some teaching from a psychotherapeutic perspective about that. And also, some of our spiritual clients may have their worldviews on social issues. Things like, is divorce okay or not? What do we believe about sexuality? About issues like abortion, crime? And so it's really important to consider those. A lot of times conservative Christians are asking for prayer or scripture involved in their session. And we want to make sure that we're doing what is in the best interest and beneficial for the client. I also document what the client's requesting in my notes. So if they say, oh, I'm calling in and I wanted to meet with you because I saw your name on my insurance panel and you're listed as a Christian provider. Now, I've alluded in the past to how much I like solution-focused counseling because, again, it plants that seed with a client that you have managed, even when they're coming to us with their problems and presenting concerns and feeling like they really haven't done well with anything. So solution-focused counseling is good because it focuses on the interpersonal exchange between the clinician and the client. And the goal is to ultimately increase the number of exceptions to the problem, helping the clients pay attention more to when they're without the problem and foster times where this could occur. So we're looking at the times that they've coped better, the times they've managed, even using what solution-focused approach is called the miracle question. If somehow you woke up tomorrow and the thing you're coming in for, that issue, just wasn't an issue anymore, what would be different? So what's different with the solution-focused approach is we're focusing and placing more emphasis on what works as opposed to picking apart and having a problem-focused. The thing that a lot of the Christian or spirituality-based clients I have say that they like is that solution-focused counseling is consistent with what they're describing as their Christian spirituality. The idea of God intervening from the future to impact the present and the presenting concerns, and that we're agents in a cooperative partnership with God. One of the things we want to be careful about, as I started talking about before, is how we define what we do. Again, when it comes to ethics about the work we do, even when it incorporates spirituality, we want to be clear that what we're doing is clinical, professional psychotherapy or counseling. So while we might include a spiritual history or narrative, that we're careful to make sure it's not defined as I'm a minister, or that spiritual transformation is the ultimate goal. We're talking as a counselor about giving a DSM diagnosis. So we're looking at treating and diagnosing things in the ICD, whereas spiritual direction or ministry is not looking at things in terms of psychopathology. So that's one distinct difference. We're also looking at, as counselors, how do we reduce unhealthy symptoms? How do we increase function? And how do we help with personality and character changes? Whereas spiritual direction or ministry has as its goal spiritual transformation. In counseling, we're looking at a dyadic therapeutic alliance. We're looking at the therapeutic relationship as being indicative of a vehicle that God can use to heal and work on people. Whereas ministry is looking at spiritual transformation and triadic relationship improvement. In counseling, again, we're focusing on ethically sound and efficacious therapeutic interventions as opposed to spiritual direction or ministry, which might be simply directly quoting a Bible verse or a church teaching on a matter. So we're not necessarily doing discipleship. In counseling, again, we're talking about a clinical relationship where there's mutual collaboration. But spiritual direction, we're talking more about a situation where there's more discernment. With counseling, when we talk about resistance, we're talking about psychological resistance versus the spiritual resistance that someone might describe in terms of ministry. So the literature talks about one of the goals in Christian or spirituality-based counseling is really emphasizing on the clinical concept of hope and purpose. This article that I cited and referenced in the PowerPoint and the bibliography talks about, quote, taking people to the healing waters. And essentially, it looks at when they're coming in, addressing the question of, does the client really want to be healed? What does healing look at for them? So the key questions that it highlights are, what is it that's really hurting them? And what is it that would be healing to them? So we're starting when a client comes in with trying to figure out their perception of things, how they're processing, how they're defining things. We're having compassion for their story. We should be demonstrating high levels of Rogers process variables. We're showing that we're reaching out to the hurting person in a genuine, caring relationship. We're trying to understand their narrative by asking clarifying questions. And we're engaging their will. So remember, just because a client's coming to us, even if they made the appointment and it's voluntary therapy, they may be at various levels of readiness for change. So we want to look at, what does this client believe are his or her resources or strengths? What does he or she believe are the limitations? So we're trying to engage their will. We're embracing the areas that they're feeling stuck in. And then we're encouraging connectedness. So we're looking at concrete behavioral goals to help them find out what is going to help them move beyond their presenting concerns. another way of conceptualizing spirituality-based issues or issues from a Christian worldview is to look at the literature regarding attachment theory in spirituality. There's a lot of history about the influence of our relationships and whether they had secure or insecure attachment. Oftentimes, the way we interact with significant caregivers or guardians or anyone we're in a significant relationship with through critical periods in our life really lay a foundation for how we tend to see God. The literature would show that oftentimes we see God on one of either two extremes. The correspondence hypothesis would say that if the attachments were sound and secure, then generally we're securely attached to God. So if this parent is safe, secure, I'm able to explore, I'm able to become who I'm supposed to be, there's room in the relationship to work through certain issues, that I might similarly approach things with God that way. The literature also suggests that sometimes the opposite's true. There's something called a compensation hypothesis, whereby a person might try to redo or undo a healthy attachment and look at God as basically someone who's an exception from the horrible badness of what they've gone through. Maybe they went through abuse, neglect, or maybe they were just fearful and didn't know from moment to moment what normal was going to be. Now, the literature also talks about, with group counseling, that oftentimes the steps of group counseling really embody some Christian healing principles that we don't always think about. So in terms of group counseling, there's things that we address like grace. So basically, giving unconditional love and kindness to other group members and people who are acknowledging what they're going through. Things like safety, vulnerability, truth, and ownership. So group members have the power to model the attitude of comfort and mercy even when someone's feeling broken. And that's really powerful. A lot of times you don't think of groups as necessarily being Christian, but there's a great way that that can influence concepts like mercy, safeness, ability to open up. So some questions that when we're addressing grace in a group context, someone might want to think of are, in what ways have I experienced the grace of God in the midst of my brokenness? In what ways have I experienced grace from others? What are some of the barriers I faced? And how did I work through them? So you see how the group really can be a great way of modeling some of those concepts in action. Sometimes the one-on-one counseling, while it can do a lot of beneficial things, can be limited in that respect because it can be easy for a client to try and negate with a therapist saying, oh, well, you're just a therapist. Well, you're just one person. But in a group context, you get more of a consensus, you get more input, and there's more exceptions to the depression, the anxiety, and the challenges that they're facing with their presenting concerns. The group therapy also can highlight the concept of safety, that this is a place where there's freedom from fear, anxiety, and apprehension as we're able to open up in this group. It makes a difference knowing that each group member can share vulnerable information and they'll be safe. Usually on the early stages of the group, there's some sense of rules that people have to sign or agree to. So things like confidentiality, lack of judgment and criticism, each person doing his or her own emotional work, the ability to pass, say we're going around in the circle or talking about issues if needed, and then things like attendance and commitment to the group. The other area where groups can be beneficial is that of boundaries. Remember, the group might be an area where someone's having to redo in a sense, just like a metaphor, some of the toxic things from the past. So it's a place of self-disclosure, listening, and validation. In other words, it's a place where the client learns that vulnerability doesn't have to be a bad thing, that sharing and risk-taking actually can be encouraged for the benefit of the group, that members together can work on carrying each other's burdens. They can learn to challenge through techniques like CBT what their automatic thoughts are, what their thinking errors are, what their behavioral limitations are, and look at what is it that God might say about this situation, or what do others in my group say. So this kind of reconceptualizes and reframes things in terms of speaking truth and love. Then there's the idea of ownership. Each person taking responsibility for his or her own part in the healing process. We also look at clients wanting prayer as an intervention in counseling. So keep in mind, this is something we have to handle delicately. So many of our clients that are requesting Christian counseling, as much as 80 to 90% of them, according to the statistics in the literature, want a therapist to broach the subject of prayer, of expectations that they want in session. But again, we want to highlight that even if those things are allowed, that it's in the context of clinically and ethically appropriate types of interventions. I like this quote that Weldon Erickson in their article said, "If we don't let clients know that we're willing to talk about their spiritual lives, if they feel it would be helpful to do, then we're in effect just telling them it's just not okay to talk about these things." What prayer does for people, whether or not it's in our session, is it creates a softening. It creates a reevaluation of things that might have been stressful, brings healing, and helps them reevaluate a sense of responsibility. Now, another way we might incorporate spirituality is we may look at narrative approaches to counseling. Remember, we talked earlier about during the assessment phase of meeting with a client that we want to hear their spiritual narrative or their journey as it's developing. So what narrative approaches have in terms of a strength is we're helping a client through the clinical process reconceptualize problem-bound stories. We're helping them reassemble a unique alternative outcome. They can consider that the story is still being written just because something hurtful, painful, a surprise, an anxiety, an injustice happened, that there is still another chapter or chapters to be written. Another approach to therapy that can incorporate spirituality is family therapy. A lot of times we see various groups culturally that really place a strong emphasis on the family. And family may not just be biological family. We may not be talking about the traditional mom and dad family. For some people, family is their community. For some people, family are the people around them who've been there for them. So we may need to create an openness to almost like a mini group in our session. There's some populations, for example, Latinos and African Americans, who may benefit from openness to more of a broad definition of family. So it's important to include in our assessment and our work with our client their idea of what they operationally think a family is. One of the neat exercises that many of my clients have found beneficial in terms of applying CBT to mood disorders has been to use the analogy of, like in the Psalms and Scripture, where David starts with, "This is how I feel. I'm hurt. I'm pained. I'm crying on my pillow at night. I've drenched it. I feel like life is not just. The wicked are prevailing. I'm getting the short end of the stick. But then ends up at the second half of the psalm. But deep down I know, God, you are such and such. But I've seen your faithfulness. But I believe, even though I don't know how, that things will turn around. So for many clients, that has been a very good exercise for them to process in terms of writing their own psalm to God. Some people can only write that first part. They're stuck in the hurt, the pain, the questions, the difficulties about the presenting concerns. And I explain to them that that's okay. We'll start with where they're at. Other people can write that whole thing. They can write what their feelings, questions, and emotions are, but then transition to a positive self-message or spiritual faith statements. Then there's a third category of people who are able to really write both parts, but really struggle with believing that second part. Just because I know that my religious background, my spiritual practices, how I've been raised teach me this, do I really, really believe this? So the literature has actually reached out to people who said that they wanted Christian and spirituality-based counseling and interviewed them to ask, what kind of things are important to you? What's been beneficial? And I wanted to share with you what clients said when they asked them. They said that references to scripture or spiritual literature were important. Knowing that their therapist was keeping them in prayer privately, even if it's just like, yes, this has been a difficult session and I'll continue to be praying for you in between our sessions. That has been refreshing to many clients. Another thing clients found beneficial was allowing them to really do a thorough religious or spiritual assessment to have room for self-disclosure, to use the metaphors that are meaningful to them regarding spiritual imagery, confronting discrepancies or different stages of spiritual development they're in and helping them process that, and then encouraging issues like forgiveness. Other things that they said were effective and helpful were supporting client involvement in a religious community. Sometimes clients struggle when they just see one-on-one a therapist telling them these spiritually affirming things, but actually having multiple people just accept, listen, be their role model. God's grace really can go a long way. Other things that might be beneficial that clients said were having their own prayer time at home, being encouraged to read and apply Christian books, whether it be the Bible or other books or narratives about people who've come through various things, encouraging confession and helping them even to do like a spiritual journal. So again, we're looking at making sure that we're using clinically effective secular methods, but also adding when appropriate that worldview of the client. Many clients who come into us asking for Christian or spirituality-based counseling are doing so because they're at what we might call a spiritual bypass. A spiritual bypass can be defined as the use of spiritual experiences to avoid or bypass psychological wounds or unfinished business. So it's almost like when you have people that tend to polarize, like are things, quote, spiritual or are they natural? That might be someone who's going through a spiritual bypass. Almost like they look at, okay, I'll take the higher road and do the spiritual thing. But actually, they don't realize that part of who they are as a whole being is someone with a variety of pleasant and unpleasant emotions, is someone that has questions and doubts and fears. So sometimes spiritual bypass can actually be a defense mechanism that might be used to compensate for low self-esteem, anxiety, narcissism, depression, or dependency. So someone might have this idea that they're more enlightened if they just look at things from a spiritual point of view. You might see someone also role modeling the spiritual bypass by outwardly signing up to be on every committee at the church and every ministry, but then in his or her individual life, really not addressing some deep-seated wounds. So another third way you might see this spiritual bypass concept occurring is when you see someone who allows others to treat him or her any way without boundaries and believes that it would be unloving to have boundaries. So we want to look at helping clients identify their patterns and things that have gotten them to this point. One of the things that clients also say is important to them is processing concepts like guilt and shame. For a lot of people, there's this thin line where it's almost like a motivator in a weird way of, you know, I want to do the good right things. If I do the good right things, then maybe more favor with God or with people. But then there's also that thin line of, wow, if I don't do quote unquote enough, am I accepted? Am I going to heaven? Have I made it? Does God love me? So a lot of times you'll hear those type of questions. One of the things we have to keep in mind too is that not everybody believes the medical model that we're trained in when we're getting licensure. Especially when we're looking at non-Western approaches, there's a lot of them that tend to involve native and traditional healers. So think about what would that look like for you if a client's coming in and saying they are talking with someone who's praying over them for healing and deliverance. Someone who's asking them to do certain things that aren't necessarily of a clinical nature, but more emphasize spirituality, the spiritual world, the influence of devils or powers or principalities, the influence of nature or magic or certain things that way. So we really want to understand the client's concepts of mental health, disease, and wellness. So it's important to empathize with the client's spiritual narrative. How can we do this? So we can ask a number of questions. Things like, teach me about any beliefs you were raised with. Help me understand what traditions you practiced. Which figures growing up or which role models have the biggest impact on you spiritually? Are your rituals similar or dissimilar to your parents? How have traditions, rituals, or beliefs changed? Tell me about a time your beliefs or traditions or rituals caused conflict. Now that can be conflict inner-wise, where within themselves, or that could be interpersonally in relationships. What makes up their spiritual support system? And then looking at the context of beliefs and how they believe those, what the religious leaders or the community that they're in says about things, and then looking at how much or how little they want spirituality involved. So how do we communicate this actually to the client? We help the client feel like his or her religious values are an accepted part of the therapeutic process. We help them know that we believe that these religious values aren't just part of the solution of their problem, but they are part of the big picture, and they are things we want to incorporate in terms of treatment planning and results and what to do from here. One of the best things we can do, again, is not generalize about every person who comes in who says he or she is a Christian client or attends church or is spiritual. We need to really come at it from the teach me approach. Really individualize to each unique client and become more educated. about his or her cultures, religious beliefs, and practices. This might even involve going as far as getting more involved in your community and finding out what people believe and what forms that takes. And then self-awareness, self-evaluation, and how you broach concepts rather than avoid them. One of the things in terms of being multiculturally competent that many clients say is that they prefer sincerity. For example, if I'm not familiar with certain denominations or certain types of religious views, for example, like I mentioned with the one guy who had a Hindu background and I didn't know that mercy wasn't a concept in his religion. It was fascinating to go and talk about that and what that's like not having that as a reality and having to process fairness, unfairness, if I get another chance, if I don't. There's even literature out there that looks at how do I do spirituality-based psychotherapy with adolescents. Most young people want to know how we're going to handle the issue of trust. They want to process things in terms of what can I tell this person? What can I not tell him or her? There's issues about reality testing, self-awareness, responsibility, how we can be flexible, spiritual awareness with others, beliefs about transformation, struggles about meaning, purpose in life, and how do you define yourself and others. So when we talk about the ethics involved in being both ethically and professionally competent, as well as incorporating a client's spiritual worldviews, we need to make sure we're not giving the impression that we're religious authorities of any sort. Our goal needs to be on focusing on the well-being or the good of the client. While clients might be interested to know what we believe and our values, we need to be sure that we're not imposing them on them or lecturing them. We also want to be careful to not focus so much on spirituality to the neglect of the whole person that's coming into us. And we definitely don't want to misuse spiritual interventions. Consultation with colleagues is really important, especially to this end. What's the scope of practice? What would another clinician do given this similar situation? And making sure we have competency, that we're seeking appropriate education. Now, they did an interesting study that I've cited here, and there's several pages in the PowerPoint, so I encourage you to actually really look at the list that's provided and maybe even look at the original article. But how much or how little, again, training was received in terms of spirituality-based factors in psychotherapy. So many people, about 97%, did have training about issues like confidentiality and informed consent. So those type of ethical issues were common. People were aware of them. How to consult with peers. How to get supervision. So certain things like that, there was quite a bit of training about. But let's look at some of the other ideas here about dual relationships, about using scripture, prayer, or other things if it's not requested. Only 50% of people really were able to look at that in their graduate training. Topics like wanting to change a person to believe a certain thing spiritually and the risks of going to that place about trying to change a client. Only 53% of those interviewed said they really, really had that issue addressed in their graduate school. Sadly, I also look at, 49% of those surveyed who said they consider themselves someone who would employ Christian or spirituality-based techniques said that they relied more on scripture or spiritual practices than ethics. So it's really important that we be very clear, and that's where I think that form letter comes in. Who am I saying I am? What are my credentials? What does the client think he or she's coming in for? And what are they really going to get? How we advertise ourselves is really important. If we're saying that we have a certain scope of practice, do we really have this? Have we really done Christian counseling work? So, for example, other things that haven't been addressed but maybe need to be addressed in terms of as we progress from here in education and competency are what our beliefs are about God answering prayer or what he does or when he doesn't intervene or how he speaks to people. Other things like how much or how little I quote scripture or quote stories versus how competent I am in that or what my role is. Or things like healing, deliverance, exorcism, and other non-traditional methods. Again, if we're operating under licensure in a mental health field in the state of Ohio, we need to make sure that what we're doing is consistent with that. One of the issues I wanted to really highlight, because it's something that many of my self-reported Christian clients have brought up, is the issue of forgiveness. Many people come in at some level really wrestling with this idea of offenses, of someone or something did a wrong to me. And so a lot of times clients have this idea that, you know, forgiveness is an important part of the journey. But they have all kind of thoughts about what that entails. Just because they're coming to us to deal with a hurt or an offense doesn't mean they're ready or necessarily at the same place we may think they're at in terms of forgiveness. Keep in mind, there's a group of clients who forgiveness might not even be what their end goal ever is. They might refuse to forgive. They might feel like they have to protect themselves against things they think are toxic in a relationship so that they decide not to forgive. The literature actually suggests that counselors thought that forgiveness was an earlier, easier stage for a client, but actually the client said, you know what, that's not something I decide till way down the road. That's not something that early on I've decided. Just because I'm contacting you for clinical Christian counseling doesn't mean I'm sure that I really want to do this forgiveness thing. What does it look like? So actually the literature would suggest that clients prefer us instead to build up social support systems and resources before they are at a place even in terms of possible readiness to consider forgiveness. Now, I had gone to a wonderful seminar years ago by Dr. Janice Abrams Spring, who talked about four types of reactions to offenses. She talks about cheap forgiveness, refusing to forgive, acceptance, and genuine forgiveness. So cheap forgiveness is something where someone might have an attitude of like moral superiority. It's kind of like, let's get through this quick. I'll make a quick decisional commitment to forgive. I remember I had a gentleman who I counseled who had found a card that was of a romantic nature to his wife from another gentleman. And his wife never told him that she was having an affair. But after he found this card, his wife said, yeah, I'm having an affair. And he basically said, okay, just stop it. Don't do it anymore. You know, what do we need to do to continue in the marriage? And when I counseled with the gentleman, the husband who had found out about his wife's affair, he did what I would consider in line with this cheap forgiveness. He said, well, I'm going to be the role model to my wife. I'm going to show her that as a Christian, I'm going to be there for her no matter what. Even though she's struggling with her spirituality. Even though she's not sure about if she wants to continue on with this other guy or not. Even though there really wasn't any processing or working through or even communication about the underlying factors, he felt like his job or his duty as a Christian was to forgive decisionally and just do that. So I didn't want to debate that with him, but we talked about some of the risks of if there is an offense, not processing that thoroughly with the other person and looking at what we want to do from here in a specific plan of action. Another approach that Dr. Abrams Spring talks about is the idea of refusing to forgive. And I think sometimes it's challenging when we say we're a Christian counselor to even consider that option, or that our clients sometimes do think of that. There are a number of situations where our clients might think they're not sure that they want to do the forgiveness thing. Imagine someone being abused. Maybe they have an idea that forgiveness means they have to have a relationship with someone who's been toxic. So one of the things we might need to find some, basically do some psychoeducation with the client about is the idea that forgiveness doesn't necessarily mean reconciliation. Now, I mentioned that there's four different ways that people might respond to situation. The third way that Dr. Spring talks about is the idea of acceptance. Now, let me clarify here. Acceptance doesn't mean agreement with the offense. It doesn't mean a brushing off or sweeping under the rug things that are significant. The person who is hurt feels all the emotions and does not bypass the emotional work of the wounded party. They're able to work through. But sometimes the offender isn't an active part of the healing process. So they're able to empathize with the offender. Again, not agree, but to put the offender's behaviors in context and look at, okay, now that I realize this is what this other person might have been going through, this is how I want to approach things from here. Ultimately, what she would call genuine forgiveness is something that takes a great deal of time, effort, humility, communication, back and forth. And keeping in mind, even though I'm using the word offender and offended, to some degree we're all the offenders, whether intentionally or not, and to some degree we're all offended. So genuine forgiveness is in which each party recognizes what types of behaviors he or she might have done that made an impact or hurt or wrong the other person. Each takes responsibility for his or her part. They assess the injury together, and there is a reprocessing of now what are we going to do from here. We're not just going to do a quick rush through. It may take time. It may involve some really difficult conversations. And oftentimes I've found with couples, families, groups, and systems where they have decided to go the route of working through the genuine forgiveness, it's time consuming and requires a lot of effort. So the offender's learning to express genuine remorse. And there's a specific plan of what behaviors will we avoid, what we do differently from here. There's also a sense of learning the ingredients of a healthy apology and differentiating what a good apology versus a not so good one is. So this is an important factor that I tend to teach my clients. A good apology is one that includes responsibility for each person's part in the offense. It's personal. Someone might say, when such and such happened, you felt such and such, you needed such and such, and you hoped for this, but this is what you got. A good apology really is empathic. It puts yourself in the other person's shoes. It seeks understanding. It seeks to take the other person's perspective. And then in response to any offenses, a good apology looks at what the specific behavior plan is going to be for the future. There may be triggers again. There may be things we need to process through again. But I firmly believe, and having worked with a number of couples especially, that in order to make changes, it's important to look at a specific behavior plan for the future. And a good apology is a deep apology. It's not just a surface level. Sorry for whatever I did. Sorry for what you're upset about. It's not just a quick rushing through. There's genuineness, and it's direct. A bad apology, on the other hand, would be something like, oh, I'm sorry. Well, sorry you got offended. Sorry for whatever's bugging you now. Or, I'm sorry, but. Remember, the word but negates whatever you said before. Another type of bad apology would be one that kind of explains away your behavior. Well, that's just my personality, my culture, the way I believe. I've always done it that way. One of the models that they talk about in the literature in terms of forgiveness is a cognitive model of forgiveness and object transformation. So that model looks at essentially making a shift between revenge-based cognitions, so beliefs that look at, you know, I want justice. This person did this wrong to me. I want them to get it for what they did, to a realistic processing of the violation, a realistic approaching and working through of the emotions, but looking at how am I going to reprocess this event so the violation or offense, as I see it, doesn't have that sting and that control over me. So again, there's a change in terms of the thought patterns. The negative cognitions would be things like, I will get even. I want revenge. This person's not going to get away with this. They will pay. I can't stand to deal with all this pain. This is just too much. I can't tolerate this. I have to get even. Versus, over time, after there's genuine processing, forgiveness-based cognitions, which would say, you know what? I'm going to choose to forgive this person. I'm not brushing this under the rug. I'm not pretending it didn't happen. But I'm putting things in context and saying, okay, let's be realistic about what we're going to do from here. So the object or image over time changes from a friend to an enemy in the negative cognitions. On the other hand, forgiveness-based cognitions allow for a genuine working through, where the object or image becomes less threatening, and there's a freedom that's experienced. So what a therapist would do in this situation is explain that forgiveness is an option or a healthy choice, that the therapist assists the client in learning how to identify the toxic thoughts and cognitions and change them. And we also, in terms of psychotherapy, help the clients realize they're not just choosing forgiveness one time, that it's going to be a repetitive thing. They're going to have to keep going back because there's going to be memories of the situation surrounding the offense. There's going to be emotions that might hit on that thing that they're coming in for and the presenting concern. Now, the literature talks about narrative interventions for forgiveness. And essentially what it highlights is, how do we tell the story of what happened to us when we were hurt? They've actually done some measurements and found that when people use a lot of emotionally laden negative words, that really can take someone into those revenge-based cognitions
and prevent forgiveness. So it's important, they suggest, for us as clinicians to look really at the frequency of the words that the client's using and to, through therapy, increase the frequency of positive or neutral words. So what this basically is called in the literature is attribution retraining. So we're helping a client to move away from a place of just ruminating on the unpleasant things, whether it's about self-issues and self-criticism or criticism of someone else and unforgiveness. Another thing that the literature looks at, and this is in the context of marriage therapy, is hope-focused marriage enrichment. And this is by Ripley and Worthington. They actually have found out that a 5-to-1 minimum positive to negative interaction ratio is important in terms of fostering forgiveness. And actually more like a 10-to-1 positive to negative interaction. When I teach things like iMessages, for example, in terms of couples communicating after an offense, I'll first teach how they can reaffirm the times things have gone well, talking about this is how I feel, this is what I would like more of in the future, this is how I think we could do that, or when I remember that we were at a better place, this is what made a difference to me. So hope-focused marriage enrichment teaches empathy, and it uses the acronym LOVE. L, being listen to your partner. O, observe your effects on your partner. V, value your partner. And E, evaluate common interests. And then the fourth thing would be to incorporate intimacy building exercises. So solution focus interchanges. And it actually encourages, in terms of a concrete exercise for couples to write a love letter to each other. So the importance being that there's a concrete affirmation, or almost like a newness in their vows of, okay, how are we going to approach things from here? Another variation of this is empathy-centered, forgiveness-based interventions. So helping people speak to their common feelings and perceptions and facilitating even a verbal commitment to, hey, I want to get through this. I want to get on the other side of things. Part of what the literature would suggest is really important in terms of successfully doing the process of forgiveness is learning to empathize with the offender to promote forgiveness. Now, when I say empathize with the offender, I'm not saying agree or support his or her behavior. I'm saying place the behavior in context so that you can see that, wow, oh, so this might be why that person did this certain thing. Oh, is it possible that if I was under that stress or in this situation, that I could have done something pretty wild too? What the empathy does is it reminds us that while we might not have done that actual behavior, that there are other times in life where someone could be looking at us and thinking, well, how in the world could you do this? And then offering humility. So recalling times that you've received forgiveness and mercy when probably other people might have wanted there to be justice or consequences for you. An example of this would be this quote that I want to read to you. I see my offender's motivations and understand his or her point of view. I feel that what he or she might have been feeling. I felt similar feelings. I see that I've done things or wanted to do things as wicked as this other person. In those instances, for my own weakness, I would have liked to have grace extended. I want mercy. Who am I to demand justice for this other person when I want mercy for myself? I know that this other person is needy. I want to help him or her. I want to release him or her from the hate, anger, and desire for retribution. That's the decent thing to do, and that's the right thing to do. So humility is basically the idea of forgive others as you've been forgiven. Again, it might not be the same offense, but that there's something that you wanted mercy for. And then make a shift from blame and resentment to a willingness to forgive. And Ripley and Worthington actually encourage people to make a verbal commitment, to make a comment aloud in the session to each other, to say, yes, I'm willing to go on this journey with you and make this different. So, as you see, there's a lot of different ways of processing forgiveness. When we're talking about parenting and families, kids really observe how parents respond to different issues. And it's really important to help parents to learn to put their child's behaviors in context rather than blaming them. So positive psychology is not about as much what happens as a person's reaction to it. So there is a way that we can choose optimism and well-being. There is a way we can empathize for the transgressor and put things in context. We can recognize our own flaws and shortcomings. We can appraise things properly. And this will result in reduced rumination. So that's something that's really important, because a lot of times we see in the literature that rumination is really linked highly to unforgiveness and to that toxic cycle of just keep thinking over and over and over about things. One of the exercises, if we're using an approach of positive psychology, might be to have a client keep a gratitude journal. It really is important to teach clients that they have some level of control over their attributions and over what they attend to. So gratitude is a cognitive affective state. It's not necessarily always earned or deserved. That it drives us to respond in kindness. And it's something that's intentionally given. One of the things that goes in line with this from the point of view of positive psychology is that we can actually imagine forgiveness and what that will look like. One of the things the literature makes a clear differentiation between is decisional forgiveness, which is just a cognitive decision. It might be sort of like a moral mandate of, oh, I have to forgive because that's what I'm required to do. That's what God wants. Oh, I won't get to heaven if I don't forgive. Oh, this will hurt me. Versus emotional forgiveness, which is actually processing through some of the hurtful emotions and learning to replace them with positive, other-centered emotions. We also have group-based forgiveness interventions that look at recalling the event, having empathy again. So that's a common step that we see in a lot of these different models. Giving as an altruistic gift, forgiveness. Again, the concept that's highlighted in most of these models is the fact that forgiveness is not something necessarily that's deserved. That maybe justice or judgment might feel like it's more what's deserved given the situation. But realizing that I, in my own ways in life, might have wanted mercy. And so how can I extend that to this other person? So this involves reframing and releasing some of this toxicity. So having empathy for the offender, but then also deciding, how do I move on? So the concept I like that this one guy used is release instead of reconciliation. So I think one of the errors that a lot of our clients make is they think that forgiveness means that they have to have some kind of ongoing relationship with the person, as opposed to release, which is more of a letting go of what is psychologically harmful, releasing toxicity and bitterness. Another type of therapy that is out there for forgiveness is contextual therapy. It looks at having insight into possible causal factors or things that might have weighed into the situation and the offense, then trying to understand things like the wrongdoer's limitations, development, efforts, and intents, placing things in the context, and moving towards opportunities for compensating and re-entering the relationship in a new way. And finally, planning of how much contact do I want to have with this person. One of the things you'll probably hear if you read a lot of literature in terms of forgiveness is the concept and the theory of intentional forgiving, which is by a person named Furch. Furch looks at the idea on a cognitive basis of forgiveness as an act of a will by the client. And he goes through all these different phases that we want to do with a client. The first being actually psychoeducation, where we're processing what forgiveness is or is not for the person. We're framing forgiveness as a choice and reconciliation as an option. That we're also framing things as a process. We're assisting the clients in receiving the offense and reminding them that the reason we're even exploring the option of forgiving is because we will remember the offense. And so then to facilitate grief and mourning, it's important to forgive for ourselves, not just for the offender. And then helping them understand that they may need to re-choose forgiveness over and over. The next step in terms of this decisional forgiveness would be actually that more intense one of working through the actual offense. So helping the offender ask for forgiveness directly. Helping respond to the request for forgiveness. Teaching less defensive ways of communicating. And then reassuring for how they're going to approach things in the future. Enright and Fitzgibbons are two names in the literature as well that also have a process model of forgiveness. They looked at how to explore past grievances that need forgiveness, any regrets people have and disappointments, how to look at what the consequences are of forgiving or not forgiving, and then doing the working through, which is that really challenging longer stage of talking, working through, paraphrasing, hearing each other. So empathy and compassion toward the offender, acceptance or absorption of the pain, and then giving a moral gift to the offender. And then finally, what they call a deepening phase, finding meaning even in the suffering. And that can be challenging. Again, these are not easy things and quick processes for a client to go through. But like I said, keep in mind when a client's requesting Christian or spirituality-based counseling, even if they're saying that they want to move beyond something or forgive, that they may or may not have fully decided that. Now, I want to close this section of the seminar with this topic, this quote about the importance of spirituality. Spirituality is a universal dimension of life that lends meaning to our existence, sets a moral standard for living, and assumes some sense of moral connection among people at the very heart of our humanity. Some spirituality is based on ethics and philosophy. Other spirituality sees its source and end in the supernatural realm of a deity and is most often expressed in formal religion. Both forms speak to morality, meaning, and the nature of an individual's relationship to the world, whether or not it is supernatural. I encourage you to listen to the audio example in which I talk to a role-played client and explore some spirituality-based issues, particularly the operational definitions of things. Thank you.